Welcome to season four of Marvel's Voices. I'm your host, Angelique Roche, and I am so excited because we are switching up the format to bring you more seasons and more in-depth conversations. Moving forward, each season will have a theme, and this season, the theme is authenticity of voice. Now, we have always talked about authentic voices, but this season, we're going to be taking a deep dive with some incredible storytellers and the real life experience and perspectives they bring to their work. Over the course of the season, I'll be talking to writers like Justin A. Reynolds and actors from Marvel Studios Loki, as well as talk to creatives about what it means for characters like America Chavez and Sam Wilson to wear the stars and stripes, and books including our very own Marvel's Voices Pride, which is where we'll be kicking things off. I sat down with Chris Cooper, who I interviewed for the Marvel's Voices Pride issue. Chris is a comic writer and editor, birder, and just generally a lovely person. As you may know, Chris was one of the first openly gay editors at Marvel and was one of the architects behind the historic issue of Alpha Flight, where the character North Star became the first openly gay character in the Marvel universe. What I love about you, Chris, is that you are a true nerd. Because people will always, like, I don't know if you get this, where people are like, oh man, you just love Marvel so much, you're a Marvel nerd. I said, no, I'm a nerd. I'm a Rod Serling loving Star Trek OG Red Dwarf on PBS nerd.
My geekdom is like Trek, Dark Shadows, you know, just original Star Trek. I can identify most episodes within the first 3 seconds. If it takes me more than 3 seconds, I consider myself a disappointment. And of course, Marvel, you know, Storm, Wolverine, Colossus, Children of the Atom, students of Charles Xavier, mutants feared and hated by the world they have sworn to protect. These are the strangest heroes of all. The uncanny. Oh, X-Men is what got me rehooked on comics. I read comics as a kid, Marvel, and I read X-Men before, you know, giant size X-Men number one changed the roster.
Original X-Men.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
All right.
Well, I'm old. I'm old.
You are older.
Let me put it this way. I was a very young child reading original X-Men. And then, you know, you hit a certain age, you fall out of comics, whatever. And then I walked into a 7-Eleven, and because, you know, there used to be 7-Elevens and they used to have comics on magazine racks. And I saw this big title that said X-Men, and they showed all these characters on this cover, including this black woman with white hair all over the place. And I'm like, wait, these are no X-Men I know. What is this?
He said, these are no X-Men of mine. Who are you?
Yeah.
So when's the first time you come in contact with comics? Like, is there like a special moment? Did someone gift you one?
No, it was actually television. It was the old 1966 Marvel cartoons with the really, really bad animation. Thor, Submariner, Hulk, Captain America, and Iron Man. And I can still probably sing all 5 songs, which is humiliating. But that was what got me hooked on comics and Marvel. And then I started reading the comics and all of that. And but then, you know, of course, it fell by the wayside. And then in my teen years, like around junior in high school, I just picked up comics again, principally through X-Men. And this was in the Claremont Byrne years of X-Men, when they were really starting to take off. And I think I picked it up right around the Knights of Hellfire saga, when they first introduced the Hellfire Club. So it was right at the beginning of the Phoenix saga, which was like, you know, when Jean Grey turned dark, I was like, wait, what just happened? They saved her from Mastermind. What just happened?
The drama of that entire portion of comics is just, it's delicious. Like, I don't have a better, like, going back and reading those comics and seeing those panels, like, I can only imagine what young you was like thinking, even in the scenes in the Hellfire Club, you're like, what is happening?
They were great issues, you know, hat tip to Byrne and especially Claremont. They did beautiful work. And I got all my roommates hooked in college freshman year. And so we were all, there's a comic book store that's still there in Harvard Square in Cambridge, Massachusetts, called the Million Year Picnic. And in fact, a friend of mine who was a classmate of mine at Harvard now owns it. When we were there as freshmen, we just went there religiously. When the comics arrived, I think it was on Fridays, the comics would all arrive. And Friday, we would rush in and grab all this stuff. And now this friend of mine owns the place, which is fantastic.
I love that. So, you know, you leave college, you're a huge comic book fan. What's next? Like, what happens and how do you end up at Marvel?
I fell into magazine publishing through, you know, friends of friends. And I'm doing that for a while. It's okay. I'm not moved. And I don't know if this happened to you, but about 5 years out of school, so, you know, about the 25-year-old, 26-year-old range, this bomb goes off and everyone you know starts getting married. I think I had like 4 weddings in one summer. So at all these weddings, everyone's catching up and they're like, oh, so what are you doing? And I'm like, oh, I'm working in magazine publishing. But I would always say, but you know, I think what I really want to do is work at Marvel Comics. And they all looked at me and they said, well, we knew that freshman year. What took you so long to figure that out? So at that point, I'm like, it's a sign. So by chance, a friend of mine from the gym, Kelly Corvacy, who I hate for all eternity because he beat me by like just a few months as the first openly gay editor at Marvel. So in all the press that has been going on lately, a lot of it says the first openly gay editor at Marvel. That is not true. Kelly Corvacy was the first openly gay editor at Marvel, and he knew when an assistant editor job opened up. So he told me. And so, you know, he got my foot in the door and I came in, presented myself, and Bob Budiansky was the guy who was in charge of the custom comics division, which is where the job opened up. So that's where I started. And he's looking at my stuff and he's like, okay, well, yeah, Harvard and working in magazine publishing. And he's like, you know, you're way overqualified for this job. And I'm like, I don't care. I will Xerox till my fingers are bloody. I just want to work here. And so he hired me happily. It was the happiest employment period of my life. It was just back then, it was sort of the Wild West. And, you know, full of geeks like you and me, and we loved it, and it was so much fun. All of us who came up in that era are still kind of bonded and still stay in touch, and it was a great experience. It was just really a wonderful working experience.
So 2 questions. So yes. 1, I love the fact that you were an openly gay editor, right? Like, that's not something that you hear in everyone's story. Some people's stories, like, No, I was in the closet until I wasn't. Like, it was, you walked in the door and like, hey, this is me. I know who I am. This is what you're getting.
There was a moment of decision, because at my last job, when I left, there was a lesbian fact checker and she and I were tight. And she, being a lesbian, was huge on sports. And me being a gay man was like, sports? What are sports? So she was a huge Yankees fan. And I didn't give a shit about the Yankees, but I thought Steve Sachs, their second baseman, was hot. So as a going away gift, she gave me a little, you know, photo thing of Steve Sachs. So when I got my desk at Marvel, stuck my photo of Steve Sachs on the wall. So in comes Paul, who was the colorist, the staff colorist at the time, big black guy and a huge Yankees fan. And he comes into my office for whatever, and we get introduced and he sees the picture of Yankee second baseman Steve Sachs on my wall. And he goes, oh, so you're a Yankees fan, huh? And I looked at him and I thought about it. And I was like, no, not really. And he goes, oh, what? You're just like some homosexual with a thing for Steve Sachs? And I said, yeah. And he didn't know what to do with that. He just kind of like backed away like, yay, yay. And that was it. You know, it was like, okay, so here we are going forward.
Yeah, hi, it's me.
I'm out, and that's it. That's me. But that was the beauty of the place. It was like, you could be who you were, and you just did what you wanted. And as long as the comic books came out, and as long as we were having a good time, everybody was cool. Not everybody. I can't say it ever affected my employment or my comfort level, or, you know, it was just a great place to be.
So talk to me about editing, though. So, like, you come into this editing job. Like, first of all, editing has changed. Break down what your job actually was.
As an editor, you were the steward of a particular book and its characters. Now, I was never a full editor. The highest I ever was an associate editor, but that meant I had books of my own underneath a full editor. you know, as an editor, you are in charge of the characters. You are in charge of making sure that the integrity, the value of the characters, that their storylines are consistent, or if you decide to go in a new direction, that it's a better direction. You know, you're the one who's ultimately in charge. But you don't exercise that directly over the content of the books. It's more by whom you hire to write it and draw it. So for example, perfect example, Alpha Flight. At that point, I was Bobby Chase's assistant editor. So Bobby, her job was to steward Alpha Flight and take it in a direction that was meaningful and interesting and keep the integrity of those characters or else take them in a new direction. And then her job was also to say, yeah, good idea. No, bad idea. Yeah, good idea. Yeah, nixing that. And that's what she did. And I, as the assistant editor, sat and listened and learned. And when I thought I had something valuable to contribute, I jump in. And so that's what the job of the editor was to a large extent. And then, of course, the other job of the editor is to keep the books on time, to make sure that everyone is turning in their stuff, that you keep to the schedule. If someone is falling behind, you get somebody to help or you get a fill-in issue. That was the other part of the job of the editor.
So for folks who may not know, like, what time frame is this about when you
On staff from 1990 to 1996, I think.
Oh, it really was the Wild West. How was the time?
Well, it was a difficult time in many respects because, okay, now I'm going to talk trash.
Talk to me, because this is also a lot. This is what a lot of people, and you know this, but a lot of people, like, this is direct marketing. It was coming much more of a exclusive. This is the independent comic book boom. This is a lot of things. Comic book writers and artists were rock stars, and that had to impact it, as well as technology is flipping, right? Like, the way you're scanning, the way you're getting in your pages, the way you're sending out your pages. There's so much transition happening right now.
The technology for producing the comic books hadn't changed that much at that point.
Okay.
You're right about the creators demanding, you know, more control and more of a stake. And God love them for it. They deserve it. But of course, you know, corporate America in the form of Marvel was pushing back. So there had to be some sort of negotiation found. Yeah. So,
talk to me about, like, what was Marvel at this time? Like
I said, it was crazy. You know, you came in shorts and a t-shirt. That was how you came to the office. I don't know if it's still that way, but that's the way it was back then. I have a tendency to quote lines from Star Wars inappropriately, or what seems to me appropriately. But it was the first place where I would do that, and people actually knew the lines that were in response and would give them back to me. So then we would bounce back and forth. Mark Gruenwald was the executive editor, and he ran something called Assistant Editor School back when I was an assistant editor on, I think it was Tuesday mornings at 9:30. And it was fantastic because it really went into the nuts and bolts of good comic book storytelling. It was great for storytelling in general, but especially for comic book storytelling. And, you know, we had contributions from, like, greats like Larry Hama. It was fantastic.
So you left basically before we started getting out characters.
Well, I was the assistant editor on Alpha Flight 106, which introduced the first openly gay character, which was Northstar. Sorry, it didn't introduce Northstar, but it brought him out of the closet.
So wait, so you were the assistant editor on that book when Northstar came out?
Yes. And I had much less of a hand in it than that sounds like. You know, backstory, as a freshman in college, I'm reading Alpha Flight, the first one or two or three issues, and I'm reading the second issue, which has a little bit about Northstar. I'm like, Northstar's gay. The gaydar was blipping. You can just tell, you know? So fast forward years later, now I'm actually working at Marvel. And I'm the assistant editor to Bobby Chase, who has inherited Alpha Flight. I think she had just gotten the book. We all knew Northstar was gay from reading the comic. You could tell. So now Bobby has the book. She has Alpha Flight. She has Northstar. And Scott is like, well, I think we should probably bring Northstar out of the closet. And Bobby's like, yeah, I think that's a good idea. It's time. And of course, I'm like, yeah, of course, that's a great idea. Let's do it. It's time. So that's the other thing you have to understand about Marvel back then. Certainly, each editor's office was its own little fiefdom. You know, they were able to do whatever they wanted with their books. you know, as long as they sold, as long as they made money, you know, they were in charge. If you were using somebody else's characters, then you had to get, you know, permission from the other office and coordinate and all of that. But
i.e. for those who don't know, if you need to go use Peter Parker, you need to go to the Spidey office.
Right, exactly. And then we send it out along, and the solicitation went out to the comic book stores, and my phone rang one morning. And it was a comic book store, and they said, we were just reading the solicitation for Alpha Flight 106, and is North Star really coming out of the closet? And I'm like, oh yeah, yeah, North Star comes out of the closet now, Alpha Flight 106. And I'm like, okay, thanks. And then I turned to Bobby and I said, yeah, I just got my first phone call about Alpha Flight 106. What should we do? And she's like, oh, well, whenever we get calls from the press or from whoever, we just have to report it to the publicity director. And I'm like, okay. So I went down to the publicity director's office, one floor down, and I said, oh, I just got my first phone call about Alpha Flight 106. And she goes, oh, what happens in Alpha Flight 106? And I said, oh, North Star comes out of the closet. And you could see the blood just drain out of her face. And she's like, I need to see a copy of that issue right away. I'm like, okay. So I go upstairs. And by the time I got back upstairs to my office, my phone is ringing. And it's her again. And she's like, I need 6 more copies of that issue right away. I go to make the 6 copies. Before I've made the 6 copies, she calls me back. She's like, I need 6 more copies of that issue right away. And I'm like, okay. Because back then it was a different era, and they were not ready, it turns out, to do what Bobby and I and Scott thought was just run-of-the-mill. And it all goes back to the whole idea stuck in the American psyche that comics are for children, along with the idea in the American psyche that gay is inappropriate for kids. Never mind that there are plenty of gay kids like me. I've known I was gay since the age of 5. Never mind that there are all these kids with gay relatives and gay friends and gay, you know, some of them gay parents. There's this dual notion. Comics are for kids and gay is not for children. To be clear, I'm not talking about sexually explicit anything. I'm just talking about, you know, like the fact that gay people exist. Those dual notions combined to create in that era a barrier to any sort of openness to the idea.
One, like at that present point in time, and for you kind of in the years, how was it being part of this? Like for so many people, this comic book was a revolution. Like North Star and like North Star's evolution, which we'll get to in a second, like is something that gets pointed to ad infinitum now on inclusivity when it comes to gay characters because it was Marvel.
Well, that's the thing. It was Marvel. And Marvel was comics, superhero comics anyway. Now, never mind that DC had had openly gay characters before us. Never mind that the independent comics had had openly gay characters. This was Marvel doing it. And so for some reason, that was epic. That was seismic for Marvel to have an openly gay superhero.
Personally, for you, like, how was it being part of that?
It was nice to break the ground. Like I said, I was elated that they couldn't pull it, that it was a done deal. We hadn't tried to sneak anything past them. We had just done our jobs. But as it turns out, we had done our job so well that it was a done deal and they couldn't stop it. So I was very happy about that.
You kept that book on time. That's what you did.
There you go. We did our jobs as editors. And then, you know, sitting there in that meeting where they kind of told us, oh, we can't do stuff like this anymore. It was nothing new, sadly, in that era, but still uncomfortable. And I'm glad they felt uncomfortable having to say something like that. I'm glad there were 2 openly gay faces in the room that they had to say it to. So, you know, that was then.
Well, North Stories, obviously, I mean, as you are a comic book fan, I'm just going to preach the choir for a second. Like, his story has now evolved, right? Like, North Star has now become a symbol of not just being openly gay, but, like, the normalization of love and marriage. And now you've got Hawkling, and you've got Wiccan, and you've got America Chavez. You've got half of the Runaways. Like, you, like, when you look at that moment in comparison of thinking all of these other characters, you've got Bobby, you know, you've got Iceman, who is now out of the closet. And, you know, for you watching this evolution, what has it been like from that moment? Because that's a moment that you don't forget. Like everything you just said, that's kind of seared in the brain, right? That's not going anywhere because it was a groundbreaking moment. But now you've had so many moments, hints. You've got, you know, non-binary characters. We now have a new iteration of a gay Captain America that's coming out for the 80th. You've got all of these different and amazing and fun things that are happening. You have a drag queen who's an X-Men. How has it been for you seeing this evolution, and what are your thoughts on it?
Well, it's fantastic. I mean, it parallels the mainstreaming for good or for mostly for good, but, you know, a little bit for ill. It parallels the mainstreaming of LGBTQ issues in society and LGBTQ people. So it was bound to happen. Marvel was sadly a little bit slower than a lot of the others to do it. But eventually Marvel had to get there. You know, the people writing comics like me are either gay themselves or have gay people in their lives. You know, there are gay people who we are working side by side with. They are in the streets. They are our family. You know, so how can you not put that in the comics? I mean, I did it with when I created and wrote Darkhold. From the get-go, the central character, Vicky Montesi, was a lesbian. That's the way she was written. She's seen with her girlfriend in the first couple of pages. They wouldn't let me say it outright, so I had a panel where this young kid finally catches on, and he goes, "Oh, you mean you're a duh?" And she grabs him by the collar, and he says, "Yikes!" And that's the way I had to put it in. But besides that explicit mention, or semi-explicit mention, it was woven into the story from the get-go. You know, her father hates her because, not only because she wasn't born a boy like she was supposed to be, but because she was not just born a girl, but a lesbian girl. And her father's a Catholic priest. This is a problem for him. So it was, you did what you could, and more people kept doing what they could, and it had to happen eventually, and so it did. And it's wonderful to see it. And I'm glad to see it taking shape in so many different ways.
And I love that, because now we get Marvel's Voices Pride, which is incredible. When you think about, you go from so many folks in the closet, so many folks who, you know, it's uncomfortable or you don't get to talk about it, you don't get to bring your full selves. You are an exception. And I love it, because I wish more people would have felt the comfort to just be like, hey, you know, I made this decision. Yeah, now you know. Okay, cool, 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 cool. Can we do work now? Can we do the thing we love to do now? But now we have a full book of queer, non-binary, lesbian, gay writers, artists, colorists coming together for Marvel's Voices Pride. Like, it's bonkers, that type of evolution.
Yeah, no, it's when I heard you guys were doing this issue, it's still kind of, even though I know things have changed, it still took me a little bit aback. I was like, really? Yeah, I just remember what it was like back in the day, and it's great to see. But, society has changed too. So if Marvel was going to stay relevant, Marvel was going to have to change, and it did.
Yeah, and I think it's from the inside out too, right? Because we have LGBTQ folks on the editing staff, folks on the host staff, new media. But man, the writers and the artists, man, it's so amazing to see. Because I don't know if you saw Marvel's Voices number one, Luciana Vecchio came out with this beautiful piece. It was his first written and drawn piece in Marvel's Voices number one. And it basically was a salute to all the LGBTQ heroes that came before the Marvel heroes. And it's gorgeous. And it became one of the biggest things out of the book. Like, it was one of the most shared images from Marvel's Voices number one. And so you're right. Like, to be able to see artists do that is pretty incredible.
Yeah, there was an issue of Hulk when I was Bobby. Bobby also was in charge of the Hulk. And there was an issue of Hulk, which dealt with AIDS. And one of the supporting characters—
Is that Jim Wilson?
Yes. And he dies of AIDS. And Bobby dedicated— what made me think of this was when you talked about the single page, but the impact it had. And Bobby, instead of having a letters page, solicited stories from different people on staff about people they knew who they had lost to AIDS or how AIDS had affected their lives. And I found it a very powerful page.
Yeah, and Jim was Sam Wilson's nephew. I believe it was his nephew or his cousin, but that is so profound because I remember the first time I was just kind of going through the list of Black characters, right? And I saw this and I was like, wow, okay. Well, that's progressive for the time in which it came out. Mm-hmm. I wasn't expecting that.
Hat tip to Peter David, who wrote the issue and did a beautiful job with it.
Wow. Talk to me about what you do now, because it seems like a lot.
Oh. Well, I don't know. In terms of professionally, I'm a freelance writer now. I am writing a memoir, which is about the intersection of race and sexual orientation and nerdiness, all seen through the lens of birding. And then a couple other irons in the fire, which I won't talk about until I know which ones of them are actually happening. One thing I would like to do, I haven't done anything about it yet, but the, for lack of a better term, notoriety that came out of a certain incident in Central Park.
Yeah, I mean, you're welcome to talk about that incident, because I think that incident hit a lot of us in a very specific way, in that it came at a moment in time where things couldn't be already more tense.
It happened on the same day that George Floyd died. The exact same day. The incident was that morning, and then George Floyd was that afternoon. So, you know, that's been talked about ad infinitum, but I mention it in that it may open a chance for me to return to something that I worked on sort of right after I left Marvel that I never got a chance to finish, which was an LGBTQ-themed online comic book, which was so much fun. It was very tongue-in-cheek, very over the top. It was called Queer Nation, and the basic premise was this comet passes too close to the Earth out of nowhere, and from the tail of the comet, these lambda rays cascade down to the surface of the planet in the form of fairy dust that triggers the amygdala of the brain, but only in LGBTQ people, so that all the LGBTQ people all over the planet suddenly develop superpowers. And what happens as a result of this event?
You love storytelling. What is it about telling stories for you? Because it's clear that you are, it's just in your blood. It's just the way your brain thinks.
Yeah, no, totally. I tend to think in metaphor. I just digest things in story and want to spit them back out in story. Perfect example, Close Encounter with the Blackburnian Warbler, which is this bird with a day-glow orange flaming throat. And it was an arm's length from me. Normally they're at the tops of the trees. It was an arm's length away, eye level, for 5 minutes, sitting there just belting out its song, and I was paralyzed. I couldn't move because here is this little tiny creature with these incredible colors, and it shouldn't be there, and there it is. And I didn't know how to express that, so the only way I could express what that made me feel was by writing a story about it, about how this little bird swallows the tears from the sun, that the sun cries at the end of a long day looking down on the earth and seeing all of the earth's life. It just starts crying tears of joy, and those flaming tears are what the bird drank and lodged in the bird's throat, and that's how it got that fiery throat. And that's why when it sings, the joy of the sun at a world full of life is known to all of the planet all over again. And that is the only way I could think of to express what that made me feel. So yes, I think in story.
And do you feel like, talk to me about how you feel like your time at Marvel impacted after you left?
Oh, huge impact. Yeah, it sounds silly, but assistant editor school was a master class in storytelling in general, comic book storytelling in particular. Working alongside, you know, even in an assistant editor, primarily Xeroxing their work, seeing the work of people like Larry Hama, who could tell an entire comic book story without a single word on the page. That's the holy grail of a comic book writer, is to tell a story completely visually. I tried to do it myself, actually, with a Star Trek comic. And I was like, okay, I'm gonna tackle this. I'm gonna do an entirely visual issue. And the way I did it was, we decided we were gonna do an issue entirely in Klingon. Because it was entirely in Klingon, I had to tell the story, or try to tell the story, as much only visually as possible. I did not succeed. I came close, But Larry Hama succeeded. But anyway, you know, Larry as Hama an assistant editor, as somebody working at Marvel, you see all these people coming up with these fantastic ideas. You know, you see their creative process. You're working with them. You know, there were times when I was writing Darkhold where we would have brainstorming sessions in some hotel room out on Long Island or across town where we would just hole up and we would all try to come up with a great idea that would let us bring all our issues together for a crossover. And sometimes it was a great idea, sometimes it was an okay idea. But the point was, you know, just working with everybody and brainstorming and kicking ideas around, it's just, it's wonderful. And you can't come away from that without having improved storytelling skills.
So I'm going to ask some very basic questions now. You're about to get them. Favorite comic book?
X-Men. Duh. And I have to be clear, because I consider it unfortunate, but X-Men, along with a lot of other titles, has multiplexed into...
Yeah, I was about to say, like, the next question was going to be, so when you say X-Men... Yeah,
exactly. A dozen different titles. Let me be clear. Uncanny X-Men from back in the day. You know, now, you know, it's changed into all these other things, but Uncanny X-Men is where my heart and soul lie.
So, favorite characters?
Storm.
He's like, no, I have one.
No, I mean, you know, Storm is just, she's just awesome. And yeah, the issue where Magneto traps the X-Men in the chairs that reduce their functioning to the level of six-month-old infants. They have their powers, they have their full minds and faculties, but they can't use them because neurologically they're inhibited to the level of six-month-old infants. And they're all in these chairs spitting up baby food. They have this robotic nanny who's putting bows in Beast's hair. It's just, it's crazy stuff. I won't go into the whole full details, but what Storm does single-handedly to get them out of this predicament, the burn art was just gorgeous. Claremont's storytelling at that point was just wonderful. And I was like, Storm, forever and ever and ever. There was no question.
Favorite writer?
Oh, that's harder.
If you can that's pick harder. One.
Okay, favorite writer. Alan Moore wrote the only comic book that ever made me cry. And that was V for Vendetta. I was newly out in college, and I was buying this black and white imported British comic called Warrior, Oversize. And in it was some of the first work of Alan Moore, before he was Alan Moore. And in it, serialized, was V for Vendetta every month or every week. I can't remember if it was weekly or monthly. So I was reading V for Vendetta. I'm like, oh, wow, this is really fascinating. And then there's a moment where it tells in flashback the story of these two lesbians and their love and how this authoritarian regime comes in and imprisons them and blows their life apart. And the woman is narrating this story because she's the only thing she can find to write the story on is a roll of toilet paper. But she wants to document the story about her experience and her love for this other woman and how it was blown apart by this authoritarian regime. So she writes the whole thing down on a piece of toilet paper and she hides it in her prison cell. So now this main character in V for Vendetta is locked up in the same prison cell and she finds that roll of toilet paper and she's reading this whole story and she hears the guards coming and she knows this last bit of this woman who went through all this is going to be taken away by these guards. And rather than have that happen, she eats the toilet paper so that they can't get at it. And I was just like, I just lost it. Because, yeah. You know, back then, we were talking the early 80s. You know, people didn't talk about gay stuff in comics, let alone with that kind of power. So, Alan Moore. Alan Moore forever.
Wow. What is it for you about the medium of comics? Because you are a comics fan across genre. You've written across genre. Because I think a lot of people forget, comics are not just superheroes. Comics are a medium.
Though one of the reasons why I love superhero comics is because it's the last bastion of myth-making in Western society.
Agreed.
I mean, you know, in terms of mythic characters, larger-than-life characters who embody something and then externalize these issues and fight them out and work them out in these larger-than-life ways, you know, that's what myth used to be about. And in Western society, myth is totally atrophied, except in superhero comics. And I think that's one reason why Marvel's superhero movies have been huge successes across the globe, because they tap into that hunger for myth that does not get fed in Western society. in terms of comics in general, it's the marriage of picture and words. You don't get that with film. You get just the picture. With a book, you get just the words. It's the combination of the two that is unique to comics, and I think that gives it a unique power to tell a story.
All right, so last question. What do you think has been the greatest impact on comics on society and pop culture?
Gosh.
Yeah, I threw that one out there. You're welcome.
It gives you, certainly superhero comics, gives you a certain moral center to aspire to. You know, it's even something as corny as and overused as with great power comes great responsibility. You know what? There's something to that, because I said exactly that to a bunch of people just last night. I was giving this talk to a bunch of people about how we need to be politically engaged. And, you know, it was a bunch of Harvard grads. And I'm like, you know what? Coming from Harvard, we have a certain position in society, many of us. And I literally said, with great power comes great responsibility. If we have this position in society, it is our responsibility to use that position to try to make the society better and to protect it and to improve it. So get busy, people. That's like Stan Lee speaking through my lips.
Yeah. Right? It means the same thing for writers and colorists and illustrators as they're making these books.
Yeah, I mean, it's just we have a chance to inspire. It may be fiction. It may be stuff we're making up out of our heads, but it comes from somewhere, you know, some deep human part of us. And we get to tell that in a way through story that cuts through the moralizing and instead shows by example, that makes it lodge deep in the heart and deep in the brain and maybe stick with us so that, you know, when we're faced with a situation, a difficult situation, we can reach in there and find what we need to inspire us to act a certain way, to do the right thing, to be our best selves.
Thank you so much, Chris, for joining us to kick off season 4 of Marvel's Voices. You're absolutely incredible. All right, that's it for this episode of Marvel's Voices. But next week, I'm going to be talking to the delightful and uber talented Justin A. Reynolds, author of the newly released graphic novel Miles Morales Shockwaves. Marvel's Voices is produced by me, Angelique Roche, Alexis Williams, and Isabel Robertson. Our creative producer is Harry Goh. Our development manager is Brad Barton. Our production manager is Larissa Rosen. And our executive producer is Jill Duboff. Our theme music was composed and performed by Kamal Wainaina.